but I will give some flavor of other anomalies that we deal with in the solar system, spacecraft anomalies especially. The flyby anomaly that is most prominent, I will talk about this anomaly as well in the context of investigation of the Pioneer effect. Before I will start this talk, I'd like to acknowledge that this is not going to be, this talk is, would not be possible without contribution from many people who are over the years contributed to the study of this puzzle. And I'm very happy that Viktor Tolf is here. He's from Ottawa. Viktor is single-handedly helped to recover a telemetry data, very unique data that we are using today. And not only that, he built his own navigational code and the thermal analysis routine that is also highly reliable for the investigation, very, very important. So there are many other people. Craig Markworth from Goddard Space Research Center. Craig was the one who actually was first person after we published the report on the anomaly. He went into public archives, he got the data, he ran his own, developed his own code, developed a solution for the Pioneer anomaly. Lou Schaeffer, who was one of the few people who suggested that anomaly might have a very reasonable explanation within the realm of conventional physics, and other people from Jet Propulsion Lab, and also people who actually helped or develop a thermal modeling. So although I recognize the fact that I'm in Perimeter Institute for theoretical physics, and my background is of course theoretical physics as well, but coming to JPL, you have to work on things that not really theoretical, because you have to, what we do, we fly spacecraft. We fly spacecraft, those spacecraft will have different agenda, different objectives. We collect the data, and then we interpret the data in terms of theories and our to improve our understanding of certain phenomena. And before we will fly any spacecraft to test gravity, we have to build a spacecraft. We have to understand how the craft works and how this spacecraft contributes to whatever signal we are going to get. So me being theoretical physics, me coming from this this background, and when I started to look at the Pioneer anomaly, and I realized that there are many areas of physics, many facets of this investigation that would push me beyond the boundaries of my knowledge, going not to look only at theoretical physics, but really spacecraft design, architecture, and operations. So here, although we're all motivated by the question, what if? What if the Pioneer anomaly is something that is very fundamental, very unique? And so the question, what if, was guiding our investigation for many years. But today, I'm not going to talk about theoretical physics. I'm not going to talk about new physics. I would rather discuss the facts that we know today. I will remind you what Pioneer anomaly is and what was the original set of hypotheses that we investigated. And then we'll focus on what is actually we're doing today. And maybe some of you saw the preprint that we put out last week, Victor and I put out last week with the review for Living Reviews in Relativity titled The Pioneer Anomaly. So it's 163 pages. Take a look at it, because I'm not going to talk about all of those elements of this review here, but I'll give you just a flavor of what the anomaly is. Moving on.
Maybe we should dim the lights.
Right. Well,
let's try.
This investigation began much earlier than 11 years ago. 11 years ago, we published the first paper claiming that there is an anomaly in the motion of the Pioneer 10 and 11, Galileo, Cassini, spacecraft, Ulysses. And so this was a Fizeref-Letters paper published in October 1998. After that, the largest study to date was published in Fizeref-D in 2002, where we get most of the knowledge about what Pioneer anomaly is today. Although with looking at the hindsight, we know things that we should not say at the time, but now we know what these things we have to say. I will allude to those statements. And we'll show that some of those things that we highlighted back in this study, we didn't have enough data to claim. And so, and this, the latest sort of contribution to this investigation was their paper discussing the new data that we were able to collect. Doppler data, which is the basic data for navigational, to navigate the spacecraft, and telemetry data. And Victor was part of that investigation since 2004. So I'm very happy that he's here today. So what the Pioneer anomaly is? Going back to the facts, we know that the two spacecraft, Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11, are subject to the acceleration, which was determined at the level 8.74 plus minus 1.33 meters per second squared, 10 to the minus 10 meters per second squared. Based on the knowledge back then, we know that it is directed towards the sun. No mechanism or theory that unambiguously explained the effect. And most likely it was onboard systematics, but none of those mechanisms were demonstrated. This was in PhysRFD paper. I highlighted towards a mechanism and theory because basically this is what we will be discussing today. Back then, we didn't have enough data to claim that it was directed toward the sun. So we should have said that anomaly was directed toward the inner of the solar system. And that inner basically would include Earth as well, because from the distances of 40 astronomical units away from the sun, the pattern, the radiation pattern of the high gain antenna would include both the sun, the radiation pattern, which determines the direction of that pretty much of the signal, would include both Earth and the sun within the same sort of pattern. So we didn't have enough resolution to claim directionality. This directionality was claimed based on the sort of anecdotal evidence from the early navigation when people navigated spacecraft going to Jupiter. And at that time, there were papers claiming that anomaly is likely towards the sun, but will also, Earth would also be included. So we didn't have enough data, I'm just emphasizing the fact, but nevertheless, anomaly proper as we know it today, as we know it until this talk, it's toward the sun, it's constant, no mechanism and no theory exists to explain. And some of those statements are still correct, but directionality and constancy, this is what we see recently, these two statements should be refined. But taking this, yes, please.
Did it distinguish in the past the direction to the center of the Earth from the direction of the moon?
No, there are four possible directions for this anomaly, and I will be talking about those directions in this talk. Four possible directions, I just answer now because it's important. One direction is toward the sun, and this direction would imply that the gravity must be modified because it would imply that likely the nature of this effect would be gravitational. Second direction is toward the Earth, so it might relate to the time standards or performance of the ground-based antenna or hardware on the ESA station. Clocks, for example, on Earth would contribute along this direction. Another direction is along the velocity vector. So what if there is a drag? There are some very tiny particles that would sort of slow down the spacecraft. And so essentially this acceleration implies that the spacecraft is slowing down. So something as if sun pulls. You can think about this effect in many ways. If it's gravitational, sun pulls stronger than we expect, or it slows down because of the drag force. And the fourth direction is along the spin axis. Spin axis because it rotates, and the spin axis actually varies the direction, the angle between the velocity vector, spin axis, direction toward the sun, and direction toward the Earth, all varying with mission. Unfortunately, for spacecraft going at the distance of 40 astronomical units and farther, you cannot really distinguish between the direction along the spin vector, along the velocity vector, and the really direction between the sun and Earth are very weakly determined. So at that level, at those distances from which we took the data, 40 to 80 astronomical units, really there was not enough sensitivity in the data to determine precisely the direction. And so, nevertheless, the claim was made that anomaly is toward the sun. So there were some other evidence. I remember Craig Markford did a study, and he actually varied the position of this. He was able to vary the position of the origin of the acceleration.
like putting it to Mercury or putting it within between Mercury and the Sun, and his claim was it's kind of somewhere between the Mercury and the Sun, which is not a statement really. And what it implies is that you really, the Earth moves around the Sun with the yearly periodicity, and spacecraft going somewhere there. So really, when you get the data, when you process the data, there's some averaging occurs. And when averaging occurs, you necessarily, the Earth motion is relevant because you communicate between the spacecraft and Earth. So the Earth is there all the time. So when you average it, you average pretty much to zero, where a zero would point toward the Sun. So if you move the point, you need that. So it's this. And the Earth is here, the spacecraft is there. So you collect data from this point, you collect data from that point, and then from here. And so what is happening, after 1 year, you pretty much average in this sinusoid, and you get the position toward the Sun. So that was partially the problem with the data analysis, in my opinion. But nevertheless, for the early mission phases, for example, for Jupiter, where the angle was larger, the angle between the Earth and the Sun, the spacecraft, was much larger than at 40 astronomical units, there would be some sensitivity. And this is the focus of our ongoing investigation, really, to utilize the early data between for Pioneer 11, for example, because Pioneer 11 went from Jupiter to Saturn. And the trajectory shows a significant articulation. I'll show that in a few seconds. So thank you for asking this question. I stopped to talk about this because it is important for you to properly understand what's going on now versus to what you knew back then. So the Pioneer anomaly, taken at its face value with the knowledge after 2002 publication, implies that there is a violation of inverse square law. So Newtonian inverse square law was violated. There's additional term, you can call it recover contribution, you can call it additional, so it's a violation of equivalence, violation of inverse square law. And basically, this is a departure from the Newton's 1 over r squared from the distances 25 AU from the Sun up. And so essentially, pioneers conducted the largest scale gravitational experiment ever, and they failed to confirm Newton's gravity. So that's why essentially the interest of this signal became so big. And not only that, not only this implication, but also, I guess, coincidence. There are many coincidences here, some numerical coincidences, some temporal coincidences. And one of the temporal coincidences is the fact that 98, you all remember what papers were published in this year as well. So, because of the supernova data, we realized that the universe was accelerating. And so the accelerated expansion. So people started immediately claiming that we see cosmological effects on the solar system scale. And the numerical coincidence that fueled those speculations was the fact that the SIP is pretty much very close to C times H. So speed of light times the Hubble constant. And we immediately come to the sort of very interesting way of speculating about the nature of this effect. So yes, indeed, we see cosmology on the scale of solar system. But as we know that it's just a numerical coincidence, but hundreds of papers were published, at least on archive. They didn't went into printed literature. So, but people claim that yes, we see cosmology, and so let's investigate this possibility as well. So, as we all are used to the fact that things that we don't know, we call them dark matter, dark energy, I call them dark force. So dark force acting on the spacecraft. And of course, there are many new physics proposals. I'm not going to talk about those, but I would rather focus on the conventional explanation because any extraordinary claim requires an extraordinary evidence. So if we say that Pioneer anomaly is something that is evolution in physics, you must present the evidence that supports that. But the paper that we published back then was not given that evidence. And so we realized that we need to do a thorough investigation. And so basically, few ideas were immediately discussed in our papers, in the papers of our colleagues and opponents. Gas leakage, because every spacecraft leaks. Basically, when you command a spacecraft to perform a maneuver, you hit the propellant line and the thrusters will implement your maneuver. There will be some impulse coming through the thrusters. When you switch it off, there's some our propellant lines are still warm and the fuel still goes drop by drop by drop. It's like you watering your plants in your garden and you switch the water off and you still see the drops going through the hose. Same thing happening here, gas leakage from the propulsion system. And the level of that leakage is very similar to that acceleration. So some people say that, yes, we're dealing with just basic effects of gas leakage. Then, of course, drag forces. And the most interesting is thermal recoil force. A thermal recoil force is due to the vast heat emitted by the power systems on the spacecraft. The spacecraft, if you fly beyond the orbit of Jupiter, you cannot rely on solar panels. You have to have independent energy source. And for pioneers, this independent energy source was the plutonium radioisotope thermal generators, fueled with plutonium 238. Essentially, thermal decay produces, nuclear decay produces, radioactive decay produces a lot of heat. And so that heat is, with efficiency of roughly between 6 and 7%, translated to electrical energy. And as long as you have nuclear fuel on board, you have electrical energy to power your systems. That's how NASA operates spacecraft in deep space, the distance beyond the distance to Jupiter. Because otherwise, you need to have a humongous solar panels, such as are going to be deployed on Juno spacecraft. Juno is the spacecraft that will be flying to Jupiter, to Jupiter moons. And the European Space Agency flying Rosetta spacecraft, which has very large solar panels. It goes all the way to Jupiter. So, but you cannot rely on this type of energy sources. They can go further than Jupiter, farther than Jupiter. So radioisotope thermal generators is the source of that heat. And so we'll talk about those RTGs in the future. So, but before we do that, let's talk about the pioneers. Very simple spacecraft. We know everything about this spacecraft. We know a lot. We don't know everything, but we know a lot. And especially today, we know that the launch dates, Pioneer 10 was launched March 2nd, went to Jupiter, passed by Jupiter on December 4th. Last data point was acquired from Pioneer 10 at the distance of 80 astronomical units out to roughly at 27th of April 2002. Pioneer 11 had a similar path, except it went to Saturn as well. So when NASA realized that they had a very healthy spacecraft after they both passed Jupiter and Saturn for Pioneer 11, they decided to start a new experiment, so it's a mechanical experiment. Why? Because this spacecraft is very simple. Spinner, much easier to navigate spin in spacecraft than three-axis stabilizer. So what means three-axis stabilization? You fly in a brick, and that brick has a thruster system that would work in X, Y, Z direction. So when you need to implement maneuver, those thrusters in X or Y or Z direction would implement that maneuver to correct for non-gravitational forces. And so this is essentially it's an active system to compensate for active disturbances. When you have a spinner, you know that it's easy just to implement precession maneuver and so to correct for any disturbances. So therefore, modeling for spinning spacecraft is much easier. And therefore, navigation for spinning spacecraft is more precise. Why I'm talking about this, because Voyagers went pretty much the same route. Went Voyager 1 today is a distance of roughly 115 astronomical units away from the sun. So the most distant spacecraft, but they are 3x stabilized. And the question you people usually ask, whether or not you see the same force, the same acceleration on Voyagers. No, and that is because of their stabilization, because of their attitude control. Attitude control using 3x stabilization allows pretty much yields a much worse solutions. In the case for Voyagers, it was at least 50 times worse than for Pioneers. So if an anomaly similar to Pioneer anomaly would exist on Voyagers, likely it is, but the noise level was so high we couldn't resolve it. So this is why Pioneers were more cleaner, and until recently, these were the most precisely navigated spacecraft because of their simplicity. They have the dish, the figure is dominated by the antenna, which is roughly, 2.74 meters. We know about that they were spin stabilized. For Pioneer 10, rotation was roughly 4.3 RPMs. And that's this rotation was achieved when the spacecraft was launched. the magnetometer and RTG booms were extended. And so originally it was spinning much faster. And then after launch, when the heat shield and everything was deployed, so essentially the spacecraft was in space to slow down, it just extended its booms and stabilized. And so for Pioneer 11, there was additional problem. There was a leakage from one of its thrusters. It stabilized at a much higher rotational, not much, but twice, almost twice, roughly 7 RPM. That was the rotation of Pioneer 11. So we know how it was communicated. It was a transponder. There was no signal transformation on the onboard of the spacecraft. Transponder would receive the frequency from the ground, and the uplink frequency was roughly 2.1 gigahertz. And when transponder would receive the frequency on signal on the spacecraft, it would transpond on the same frequency back down to the ground with some multiplication. But roughly, it was not, the frequency was not affected by the spacecraft systems. And the signal down was 2.3 gigahertz, which we're receiving on the ground. It's roughly 13 centimeters. And as we knew back then, we knew that it was a continuous signal, 8 watts. 8-watt signal, which was transmitted up and down between the Earth and the spacecraft. And so that's the everything in the nutshell. This is what we know about the Pioneers. The simple spinners, very easy to navigate. Let me speed up a little bit. This is the picture of launch on March 72, that's the 2nd of March 1972. This is the launch spacecraft. Pioneer 10 was the first spacecraft that went through the asteroid belt, reaching Jupiter, first picture close-up of Jupiter, the red spot, and then the Pioneer left the solar system, and Ames spacecraft that was managing the mission was heavily sending those postcards out, right? And so this is the trajectory. Pioneer 10, you see, goes from Earth to Jupiter, then went on hyperbolic elliptic escape trajectory from the solar system. Pioneer 11 went to Jupiter, and then went to Saturn. This is the question about direction. See, now, this guy is a hyperbolic escape trajectory, and Pioneer 11 going from Jupiter to Saturn, velocity, spacecraft velocity there, and antenna would be always struck to the Earth. See the articulation between antenna, the Earth pointing, sun pointing, velocity vector, and spin axis would be much larger for Pioneer 11 going this along this trajectory. So this is why it is important. Now, last signal from Pioneer 10 was received on January 23rd, 2003 from distance 82 astronomical units. So after that, there is no communication with the spacecraft. The data that we have on the ground, this is all. So we don't expect anything else. For today, Pioneer 10, I think it's the distance roughly 101, about 100 astronomical units away from the sun. It moves with relatively constant velocity of about 12 kilometers per second. And it takes a pretty much round trip lifetime of roughly 29 hours. So you send the signal today, you go home, you sleep, you come back to work at night after a nice night, and you get the signal back. So imagine how long it takes. One way, it's roughly 15 hours, or just about that. So the distance is significant. Just to remind you, the distance between Sun and Earth is 8 minutes. Between Earth and Mars is 16 minutes. So the light goes between the two of these bodies. So when you navigate spacecraft, when you navigate rovers on Mars, it takes 32 minutes for signal to come. I mean, it varies, of course, because of the distance. But it's half an hour. You implement the command, and you know that you want rover to go this way. And you see only after 32 minutes whether or not rover did what you want. So it adds additional complexity. And so, but in this case, we're talking about hours, not minutes, so it's far away. Moving on.
So, the transponder stopped working in 2003?
The amount of nuclear radioactive fuel, amount of plutonium. So those missions were expected to operate for 3 years. And so we're talking about 32, 33 years. So 10 times longer, essentially. They gave as much plutonium as to make sure that it will survive for 3 years. So the amount of plutonium essentially depleted just below the threshold so that the spacecraft was not able to generate the return sequences. So that's the main reason. There was not enough fuel. And the machines did an excellent job to survive for this distances and still providing very excellent data.
And the last data point, when data was still received, the main mass voltage on binary 10 was already significantly down, so it was a minor miracle that the transmitter was still working. It was really no surprise that a few years later there was not enough.
So moving on, the pioneers were, as I mentioned, very healthy. After lunch, going to Jupiter and to Saturn, NASA decided to start a new experiment, looking for a celestial mechanics experiment, looking for additional planets, Planet X. Back then, we had 9 planets in the solar system. So and now we lost one. So basically, back then we were looking for the 10th planet. So now we would be looking for the 9th. But the idea was the highly precise trajectory would be affected by the gravitational flyby. If you're flying by a gravitating body, trajectory would be sort of jogged around and basically you would see the signal. And so we were looking at the data, looking for that planet in the solar system. In addition to that, there was a gravitational, first ever limit on the low frequency gravitational waves came from pioneers, because pioneers were used to search for gravitational signals. At this distance, solar radiation pressure, which points away from the sun, reached the level of roughly 5 × 10⁻¹⁰ meters per second squared. And by 1980, we realized that the spacecraft affected the largest systematic affecting both spacecraft at the level of roughly 8 ± 3 × 10⁻¹⁰ meters per second squared. This is what you see. this is solar radiation pressure, 1/r². And this is the data that we were getting from the spacecraft. So it was the discrepancies right there, pretty much unmodeled effect is here. And so that was the first indication that yes, there is something happening on the spacecraft. And looking at this plot, which was composed from the early data, so from the early solutions, you see here the circles are for Pioneer 10. Pioneer 10 is here, and the sort of field circles are for Pioneer 11. These data points are sort of plotting the data for the same time. So to speak, this point is contemporary with that point, and this point for contemporary for that point. But it allows us to actually look at the heliocentric behavior of this anomaly. And it looks like, if you look at this plot, anomaly was non-existent until Jupiter, and then suddenly it went into canonical value. That also contributed to a lot of speculations what actually poisoned the anomaly. I think now we know much better what might have caused this part of the onset, and I'll talk about that if we don't have time. Talking slowly, using too much time already to explain things.
So how come the error just shrinks from that huge thing at 10 AU?
You know, going through Jupiter and Saturn, and then basically. Then you go escape trajectory, very stable trajectory, so to speak. There's some events going on the spacecraft, lots of maneuvers. And so now you don't maneuver spacecraft, it just goes across along the trajectory, and the data is very clean. So uncertainty is a realistic uncertainty that you get from the data. So moving on, just to summarize, back then there was a realization that Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11 affected by the acceleration at the level of roughly 8 × 10⁻¹⁰ meters per second squared. And back then, there was a question, what if this is due to the code that we use? Maybe there is a numerical problem within the code. After all, orbit determination program is about 20,000 lines of code. And so what if there is some little error crept into one of those formulas that we use, and it just shows up like here, well, like this. So we decided to motivate NASA to fund an additional group, the Aerospace Corporation, LC Dund, and near LAX. So that it gave them the data that we used to analyze. So for Pioneer 10, they got 11.5 years of data, essentially 20,000 data points, the distance between 40 and 17 U. And similar data points, but much shorter time span for Pioneer 11, roughly 4 years of time span, and roughly 20,000 data points as well. So this is what they came up with. So this is the chart that you can see. This is the time along the x-axis, and y-axis is Doppler velocity. Doppler velocity is essentially what we do. We receive what we measure frequencies. we send frequencies from we send the uplink signal on this uncertain frequency, and when signal comes back, we get the frequency of the signal on the ground. Essentially, that signal would have everything, all the dynamics. To properly model that signal, you need to account for the fact that the Earth is moving around the Sun, there is an interplanetary medium, there is a spacecraft going at a certain velocity, you have Lorentz contribution, you have general relativistic contribution, because the frequency is affected by the local gravity in the solar system. So when you model everything, you expect that the residual would be zero, observed and modeled would be zero, but in reality we see sort of a linear trend with time. And so when you interpret this with velocity, observed and velocity, this is two-way. It's not one way, for one way it will be just one factor, one, but it's two-way signal. So up and down, essentially. So you see that observed minus model, the total velocity is right there. And so that's the signal that was puzzling us. And if you use only one parameter in the model, that parameter is a sub p, you get those residuals flat. What I mean by flat, I just want you to appreciate the fact that we talk about 2.3 gigahertz communicating the frequency that you communicate, and this is millihertz. So we're talking about at least 12 orders of magnitude of the signal you need to collapse to make sure that our model is correct. And one parameter allows us to see that the data is actually when land very flat. Those spikes are expected because once in a while, they start going behind the sun, the solar plasma affecting the microwave frequencies. And when we propagate through the solar plasma, it's essentially this is the effect of the solar plasma. And you see this with the spikes. And so pretty much we truncate data to when spacecraft going behind the sun, then we don't have the signal at all. But coming to roughly about 10 solar radii, we cannot communicate with the spacecraft with the solar plasma at this particular frequency. The higher the frequency, the more the closer you can get to the solar plasma. But that's what the story was about on the Pioneer Pen.
This plasma at larger distances, I mean, there could, it could exist. And the question is, do we understand it well enough and model it so that at 40 AU, you could have interplanetary plasma that changes the propagation of microwave?
So there are two questions. First question, I just want to separate the two. I use the word plasma to characterize the solar environment. So this is one type of plasma.
Yes.
So the density, you know, goes very dense around the sun, so sure. But then what you're asking is another type of plasma, interplanetary plasma.
Okay.
And so yes, we know enough information, and we can get this information basically Ulysses spacecraft was studying plasma in the solar system. They are Voyagers. Voyagers used their evidence, their indirect evidence that amount of plasma and the amount of dust one would need to explain Pioneer anomaly would be enormously large. We're talking orders, at least the orders of magnitude larger, density should be. Let me remember, I think you need to have 10 to the minus 16 cubic grams per cubic centimeter to explain the Pioneer anomaly. But the data shows that we have as much as only 10 to the minus 19 and 10 to the minus 21 grams per cubic centimeter. So this is the discrepancy. We're talking about 3 or 4 orders of magnitude. And the two numbers I gave is interplanetary dust and interstellar dust, because there are two sources of dust in the solar system. Asteroids are crashing against each other, producing dust, releasing dust, 10 to the minus 19. And the interstellar dust, there is a stream of interstellar dust that comes from outside the solar system, 10 to the minus 21. 10 to the minus 16. So that's just totally outrageous number. That's the puzzle. So now looking at the possible model terms in the model for the Pioneer motion and the propagating the solar system. First of all, the model is fully relativistic. With the general relativity understanding for Hoffman equations to model the motion of the spacecraft and the planets in the solar system. We have the terms V over C to the fourth. There's Newtonian gravity from asteroids, from the body effects. There are lots of other terms. The relativistic models for light propagation, I corrected V over C to the second, Shapiro correction, and the V over C to the third. Actually, recently we have those terms. But the reason I'm saying is that we have, it's essentially it's overkill, because Pioneer spacecraft is really a Newtonian source. eventually need to model, you know, post-Newtonian gravity effects on the pioneer, but we just model it anyway. Just for you, just to sort of size up the effect, at 50 astronomical units from the sun, the pioneer anomaly would be about 4 orders of magnitude less than Newtonian gravity affecting this spacecraft. Post-Newtonian gravity would be 5 orders below the pioneer anomaly.
So PPN, what is essentially, you have Newtonian force, and the contributions from GR would come 5 orders of magnitude below pioneer anomaly. So this is the largest effect after the Newtonian gravity in the outer solar system. So the significance of it is large. Immediately you can think of, why don't we see this effect on planets? Why don't we see this effect on satellites? The satellites of planets or asteroids or comets or everything. We looked at all of them. Back then, the data was, in 2002, the data was not sufficiently precise. Now we can see that most of those bodies do not see the effect, especially the outer solar system bodies, which we, in the inner solar system, Mars, Venus, Mercury do not see this effect for sure, because we have positions of Mercury, for example, positions of Mars, we know it's less than roughly a meter. Between Earth and Mars, the distance between Earth and Mars is a meter. And the perturbation that would be relevant to the pioneer anomaly would be at the level of 100 meters. So we don't see this effect on the inner planets. We thought that maybe imprecise the orbits of Jupiter and the outer planets. We knew at that time with very poor precision as far as today is concerned. We knew, for example, Uranus was known at the level of roughly 25,000 kilometers. And so for this precision, you can hide the pioneer anomaly in that uncertainty. But the present data shows that the uncertainty in the planetary position is improving. And again, those planets do not show the effect of the pioneer anomaly. So, but nevertheless, we looked at those models, we looked at everything that, yes, please.
How do we get the position? Is it also through reflecting radial wave? Is there a method difference to determine the position of the planet?
Excellent question. Most of the knowledge on the inner planets comes either from landers on those planets or from orbiters going around those planets. And for the distant, and also a radar ranging, we bounce the microwaves from the surface of those planets and get the signal. And so we know where positions of inner planets. For the outer planets, flying by those planets produces a data point, very precise data point. For example, Pioneer flew by Saturn, and then Voyager flew by Saturn, Cassini flying around Saturn. So this allows us to improve the knowledge of this position of this of Saturn, for example. Uranus and Neptune were visited by NASA spacecraft as well. So when you're flying by those spacecraft very close, you can fix sort of the position of the, you know, the trajectory of the incoming spacecraft, and you can relay the position of the planet very high accuracy. So for the outer solar planets, outer solar system planets, spacecraft data flying by those planets was very helpful to build, to get the knowledge of the orbit. And as you know, we operate, we have our own solar system at JPL. So the solar system sits in the computer, essentially the ephemerides of the solar system bodies. And as more data we collect from the spacecraft, the data, the position and precision of the solar system, sort of the ephemerides improve. And we use this to navigate spacecraft. And so that's how this knowledge is obtained. So there are many other effects that affect the motion of the spacecraft and radio electromagnetic wave propagation, the attitude control propulsive maneuvers, solar radiation, wind pressure, torques produced by those forces, many different forces and effects. For example, precession rotation, sidereal rotation. The Earth is an elastic body. It moves around the sun. It rotates. There are lots of effects affecting the motion of the Earth. For example, when tidal wave, the ocean tidal wave comes to Los Angeles, it pushes the Pacific plate, tectonic plate, ever so slightly, so that the DSN antenna, which is through the mountains in Goldstone, about 160 kilometers inland, moves by 1 or 2 centimeters, by about 1.5 centimeters. So we have to account for those effects daily basis, because you know the waves are coming to Los Angeles, I mean to the, it's an effect called ocean loading. So you have to account for those tiny forces that we don't really take notice as a human beings, but to navigate the spacecraft, we need to account for those forces. Another effect that is pretty evident, you remember the devastating earthquake that hit the Middle East Asia on December 25th, about 4 years ago. So that the energy release and mass redistribution in the Earth crust essentially slowed down the Earth by a few milliseconds. The Earth rotation changed because the moment of inertia, the global moment of inertia changed. So you all remember the figure skater, you change the moment of inertia, it's speeding up, speeding down. So the same thing happened with Earth. The Earth rotation changed by a couple of milliseconds. We have to account for those effects in the ODP because we need to know it relates to position, relates to timing, relates to synchronization. So all of those forces are accounted for. So now speaking about the spacecraft, I'm just giving you the size of the effect that we deal with on a daily basis. Before we reach relativity, before we reach the new physics, we need to understand our instruments well. So to make sure that our instruments give, we would know exactly what our instruments telling us. In our living rooms, in our houses, we have light bulbs. Light bulbs would be 60 and 80 watt or 100 watt. So in our fixtures. Now we go into more efficient light bulbs, but still we're talking about tens of watts. Pioneer signal was only 8 watt. And imagine that 8 watt, tenth of what we see in our kitchens, in our living rooms, we saw from the distances of 8 astronomical units. So the DSM complex, the antenna dish, 70 meter antenna dish, was growing with the spacecraft receding from the solar system. Originally, it was a small antenna, Pioneer antenna and Deep Space Complex in Goldstone, 16, 24 meters, now it's 70 meter antenna. So to navigate spacecraft that transmits only 8 watts, you need to be able to really, we're talking about femtowatt power coming to the antenna. You need to cool it down, you need to be sensitive to your signals coming from deep space. And so we're talking about very tiny amount of energy that actually reaches the Earth and impacting the dish of the antenna. So those effects we also need to model. And essentially when you go the antenna, you need to know the precise position, the center of that antenna, because we need to know the position of this antenna to less than a centimeter on the ground. So enough about this, and just, I hope my point here was to give you sort of the level, the size of the effects that we need to deal with to navigate spacecraft, especially those that like Pioneer. So moving on, we looked at those effects, at those forces that we knew, and we sort of composed an error budget for the Pioneer anomaly investigation. And this error budget, the forces external to the spacecraft, they're all negligible. You see, we looked at the solar radiation pressure, solar wind contribution, many different effects. They're all negligible in terms of 10 to the minus 10 meters per second squared. There, you can safely disregard them. Computational systematics, again, we deal with a significant number of forces, sort of the computation. It's a significant numerical crunching problem, insignificant. And the third group of systematics is the systematics on board, which is very, very interesting. Let me highlight a couple mechanisms which we originally dismissed, but now we are investigating them to a better precision. Yes, please.
This is probably way smaller. So if you wanted to get a constant acceleration from extra mass in the solar system, it would have a constant density, right?
You would probably have a distribution like a torus. Distribution in a torus goes 1 over r. And so when you take the density, and so when you take this density and compute the acceleration, the first term would be a constant term. So you have you must have a very special distribution of matter that would produce your constant acceleration. It's not just a uniform, because you need to have.
The acceleration would normally go as 1 over r squared from the sun, and you
want to
make it.
You want to go. So you want to. So basically, there were papers publishing possible density distributions. And if you have dark energy or mysterious mass between distances of, let's say, 30 astronomical units all the way to the 70 astronomical units, distributed in the torus, and with the 1/r the distribution, the density profile, you could get something like a Pioneer anomaly, but at the expense of bringing a significant mass in the solar system. The mass that you would have equivalent, it's like 10% of the solar mass. So that's just very large amount of mass that would be able to produce something that would resemble Pioneer anomaly.
You presume that large mass would seem
awful. Yeah. So it was totally unrealistic. But now we can talk about this because we went through looking at those mechanisms and seeing, now it's interesting. At first the physics is right, but then you have to sort of look at the numbers and see if it matches the intuition. And many of those hypotheses did not. So let's talk about standard physics. For theoretical physicists, maybe a little bit boring, but that's reality. Before we get to claim something, we need to understand what actually might be responsible for the effect that is interesting. So these are the radioisotope thermal generators. You see one and two, three and four. So RTG is total energy produced by the RTG at launch was roughly 2,500 watts. For you to be able to produce anomaly, you need to have 67 watt power directed along the roughly spin axis. So you have 2,400 and you need only 67 watt. The question is, do you have that much anisotropy in the total radiation emitted from the spacecraft? And original claims that we looked at, geometry and the knowledge of the the operational knowledge of the RTGs, we said, no, it's not possible. But I'll come back to that. Let me talk about the two possible mechanisms. See, you have a source of heat right here, and another source of heat right there. And what if infrared photons emitted by the RTG impacting the backside of the antenna? Remember, it's a parabolic dish. They transfer momentum to the backside of the antenna. And because the spacecraft rotates, the component of this momentum that is perpendicular to the axis of rotation averages out. You don't care about it. But if it's along the spin axis, here you go, you have something. And because it's concave, so basically you see that it likely would produce force pushing the craft towards the sun. So this is one mechanism. Another mechanism, essentially, these are the cables. These are the cables that take electrical energy into the spacecraft systems. And so this is the instrument compartment. And all the instruments are sitting on the backside of the spacecraft. And essentially, they consume energy, and they do what? They release heat. And so this extra heat is being emitted through the passive thermal control system called louvers. Those louvers are operated as bimetallic plates. Essentially, for certain temperatures, when the temperature inside reaches certain values, they open, releasing the heat from the compartment. And when the temperature is lower, they just close. And so our expectation back then, first of all, we looked at the data 40 astronomical units away, so all the louver system were closed. And so we thought, no heat is escaping. But in reality, it's not really correct because those louver system are aluminum, so they actually conduct heat like crazy. So essentially, yes, at a lower pace, but they still conduct heat. And that's what we now investigate in our study, contribution of this mechanism. It's infrared emission, it's a thermal recoil force, and another force coming for electrical heat from the instrument compartment. But these two mechanisms came against our intuition back then. Why? Because the total recoil force, total thermal force, which total electrical power available on the spacecraft was roughly 165 watt at launch. And our data were at distances of roughly, 87 from January 1st, 1987, it was 97 watt power on the spacecraft available. Last data point corresponded to 65 watt power available on the spacecraft. Therefore, you see roughly 30% power reduction. If this mechanism would be responsible for the Pioneer anomaly, you should be able to see a significant reduction in the power on the spacecraft, similar to this 30%. We haven't seen it. So that was the basis. We said, no, it's not possible. Now we know that the possible interference, interaction between different mechanisms on the spacecraft. You get the energy, some source of energy down, at the same time some sort of energy may go up, and so they actually would be able to compensate. And so there are some hints that this mechanism actually might be viable. But what we did, we constrained those forces back then at this level. And remember, I was talking about radio beam reaction force. So this 8-watt signal that we see from the spacecraft at the receiving at the really small levels of power, they contribute to bias. Actually, this 8-watt pushes the spacecraft away from the sun at the, with acceleration 1.1. So a light bulb, remember, actually your photon rocket, so to speak, those this communication signal actually pushes the craft away. We need to account for that to make sure that we actually get to the real signal. So as we discuss this investigation, you see how many different areas of physics you go through before you reach your conclusion. But this is the summary. So we looked at the various mechanisms, the nominal thermal radiation due to plutonium, looked at the heat rejection mechanisms, many different forces. Those mechanisms were rejected because all of them would show either temporal or spatial dependence for the anomaly. And because we haven't seen it, there was a rejection. And so back then, this was the summary. So we knew that the acceleration is constant towards the sun. This numerical coincidence helped to, you know, people to publish many papers on that. So, but main focus of the investigation today, it's like, you know, Hamlet, the hit or not the hit. So basically, what are we dealing with? We were lucky. We were able to get since 2002, roughly 2003, 2004, we were able to get significant amount of data. And so that's the data. How many of you remember how magnetic tapes is being read? How many of you played, you know, tape recorders? And so I haven't played these tapes. I played tapes back then. But this is 8-millimeter track, 8-track tapes. So basically, it's mainframe computer. These tapes were sitting on the staircase at JPL. I was lucky to find these tapes in the boxes. See, it's Pioneer and sort of the dates for those tapes, and this is the Pioneer. So you see, not only we didn't have a proper computer system to read those tapes, you need to have a reader. You need to have a software that would be able to interpret your information in appropriate format. So just imagine, just think about the following. Pioneers were launched on punch cards. And so to today's software, we go with C++ to navigate, to reuse that. And now imagine all the navigational software and data formats since punch card time. You go Fortran 66, Fortran 77, Fortran 99, C, C++, and the same formats for the data that were always updated. So even if we read this, if you would be able to understand on the machine, and you would be able to get this from analog form into digital format, we still needed to have the software to be able to read it in the present date. And so that was enormous effort that actually pushed us back significantly in time. I was hoping that, nonsense, we can do it in a couple months. It took us, what, 8 years at least
to get through
that. So essentially, it was very unexpected delay. And not only that, see, those tapes, back then we were trying to save, the tapes were expensive. So people, instead of writing one file, they would write 16 files on it. And so when you read this, when you command your machine, it is very archaic tape reader, the size of the table. So essentially, when you say that you need to read only this type of file and that type of file, it would just, you know, skip a couple of files. And it takes 90 minutes per tape. And 400 tapes, you see, you know how I spent my summer in 2004. So a lot of hours spent in the sort of one-on-one with those tapes. And so not only that, those tapes were preserved in the environment that is not really magnetic tape friendly. The door, which is, door to the building is only, about 9 meters away. So large door, you get in, the humidity and the temperature, nobody cares. So reality is that many missions that NASA flies today, we don't have data because the data rights are given to the PI and the data are pretty much used by the PI and the team for 1 or 2 or 3 years. And after that, this group of people is supposed to put the data public. How many missions do you know that make this data public? I know only a few missions. And most of the planetary data is not publicly available. So the same thing with Pioneers. Only few years, roughly 10 years of data was available. And here we're talking about very early data, and so which was not available. And in a way, it was a treasure hunt. We found some data that made shed light on the Pioneer anomaly. So in a way, we were lucky to get a significant amount of data back then. So remember that we started, and we hoped we thought we would get that much data, almost 30 years of data, significant distances, significant number of data points, maneuvers for Pioneer 10, for Pioneer 11. So we were able to read this data. It was not only the only source of data. We also went to different NSSDC, National Space Science Data Center, to extract data from there. But then those data files were written in Alpha computer, Alpha DEC. So you remember the binary system and sort of the way they write the digits. And so they wrote those data in Alpha DEC numerics, and we were getting the data and back using HP. And so HP computer adds additional bit on every single line. So when you realize, when you get the data, you realize that the data is corrupt. You cannot do anything with this data. And only after some investigation, line by line, you realize that, yes, there was a nature of the corruption. And Craig Marquardt did an enormous work, actually, manually entering and sort of writing, trying to write something to extract the useful information because of the, you know, computer system mismatch. It's space archaeology. It's like CSI, what is criminal investigation. You're looking at what actually happened. So, but now we're talking about those directions. Now we have the data that will help us to study the possibility that anomaly is either spin or either Earth, Sun, spin axis, or velocity vector director. And this data that I mentioned, this data for Pioneer 11 between Jupiter and Saturn, is very helpful to investigate another fact that we can actually see the largest articulation between these four vectors is evident here. And this data is also useful for another investigation. Look, it's 3 o'clock and I'm running late, and I apologize for that. So if you, I probably will continue for maybe 10, 15 minutes if that's okay, but I can speed it up. So I apologize for that. So this type of investigation, this type of data can actually help us to study another anomaly that I'm getting into, the flyby anomaly. Flyby anomaly is another anomaly that is repeated with different spacecraft. We're talking about Galileo, Cassini, a near-Earth asteroid rendezvous, Cassini, Stardust, Rosetta. This is the data that spacecraft Galileo went to fly by Earth in October, in the 10th of August, I'm sorry, it's 8th of October, 1919, altitude of 960 kilometers. There was anomaly detected. And I can talk about this anomaly in a few minutes. But basically, this every Earth flyby was anomalous. What it means is that during the first flyby for Galileo spacecraft, nominal velocity of the spacecraft during flyby was roughly at 9 kilometers per second. But then during the flyby, how do we do this? For each spacecraft, it flying by Earth in a very different trajectory, unique to its specific mission. For example, the closest approach might happen to any point above the Earth, pretty much depending on where spacecraft will go after the flyby. Why do we need flybys? Because our chemical rockets not allow us to reach certain distances in the appropriate time. So we need to gain energy by flying by Earth and getting Earth momentum, sort of energy. So the Earth shares some energy with the spacecraft in place of the craft in a very different trajectory, with very different velocity. And so Galileo, when it flew to Jupiter, essentially had flown twice around Earth. And so when the spacecraft approaches the Earth, we track this spacecraft on incoming leg. We track it, and then because the flyby goes very fast, no GSM antenna can do very fast motion. So, but then we lose the signal during flyby, and then we pick up the signal on the outgoing leg. When you match the two trajectories, you're supposed to get zero, so you know everything that is happening. But in reality, these are the anomalies. Essentially, for Galileo first flyby, the mismatch was at the 4 millimeters per second. And now DSN is capable of tracking signals at 10 micron per second. And we'd be dealing with millimeters per second. So just a significant amount of fun problem right here, because we don't, we are not used to see the discrepancies at millimeter level. Most of the spacecraft at microns per second. And so now you see a significant anomaly with Galileo. For Galileo's second flyby, we realized that we're dealing with something very unusual. So we requested Air Force to put a special communication satellite called TDRS. And so TDRS was placed above the closest approach. And so basically from space, we were able to get the full coverage of the trajectory. Unfortunately, it was very low in the atmosphere. The flyby was very low in the atmosphere. Was a significant noise coming from the atmosphere. And so basically, we didn't get any reliable solution. And for a number of years, we forgot about those anomalies. We studied it extensively, but then we realized, OK, maybe something is we just don't understand. But then the sort of the deck of the house of cards became sort of a fall one by one. NEAR had anomaly, then Cassini, Rosetta, Messenger. Rosetta is a European spacecraft. And you see very different solutions. It's 4 millimeters per second. For NEAR, it was 13 millimeters per second. So for Rosetta, it was 2 millimeters per second. Remember, microns versus millimeters. So still very large number. Unfortunately, we don't have any hints as to what this anomaly is, what is the nature of this anomaly. We know. No. Those trajectories are very different inclinations, very different sort of altitudes, very different declinations. And in reality, there was a study done by a few people. For example, let's focus on NEAR spacecraft. I'll answer your question in a minute. So looking at the NEAR spacecraft, you track on the incoming leg, you get very very nice residuals, nothing. So you get the full data coverage. Incoming leg, then there is a gap, then outgoing leg. You fit your trajectory on incoming leg, and you expect that you will be able to get the signal on outgoing leg. That's the anomaly. So, but now if you decided that you know very well the outgoing leg, you fix that data and you propagate it backwards, you get that jump. So essentially, there is the way anomaly is evident in the data on multiple spacecraft altitudes, multiple spacecraft architectures, and we don't really know what's causing it. So this is the velocity of the spacecraft, kilometers per second, on the closest approach. And this is anomaly. It increases and decreases, so it varies. But at the closest approach, it's roughly 13.5 millimeters per second squared. Now, people published, I'd like to point out that this anomaly was reported in two publications. One was PhysRef Letters. I believe in PhysRef Letters, people claimed that this formula would be able to explain the anomaly. What it is, it's a velocity at infinity. It's one of the parameters in Keplerian motion. So our velocity at infinity, it's equivalent to delta E, sort of energy release, or change, energy change through the during flyby and versus the total energy. K is some sort of a coefficient, and delta is a declination of incoming and outgoing lag.
Science, I think, explain it that the right word.
That again?
This fits that
normally.
It doesn't explain it.
I'm sorry, if I said that it explained, it's not explained. They claim that it fits the anomaly. It fits the anomaly. And so the factor k would be sort of Earth rotation, you know, omega, the Earth rotational velocity, and the r is sort of the Earth radii. And so they claim that most of the data is can be fit with this formula. But in reality, no. It's not. And so what the prediction was for Galileo first, second, NEAR, Cassini, Rosetta, this is the velocity, nominal velocity of spacecraft going through its flyby. And this is the anomaly, 3.9 millimeters. And this is the prediction based on this equation. It's kind of close to, you know, for Galileo 1, you see the anomaly here, and it's close to what the formula predicts. And then for NEAR, it's also reasonably close. And that's pretty much all. The two recent flybys for Rosetta mission do not fit anywhere close. So I'd like to leave it at this, just basically introduce you to the point that yes, indeed, there is another anomaly. We have no idea what's causing it. And so we looked at the possible possible reasons for this anomaly. The non-dependency is a sort of an asymptotic right ascension incoming and outgoing leg, depending on the angles that you mentioned. So it's not direction toward the sun or moon, closed approach distance, orbital deflection, orbital inclination. And the models for those flybys are very precise as well. We model the airlift because it gets into the atmosphere, sort of airlift, it's air drag, the uneven heating, lots of different things. No. And I think Steven Adler placed the paper, published the paper claiming that possibly it's a scattering on dark matter that might contribute to this effect. I'd like to leave it to this because I don't think it really relates to dark matter. My gut feeling is that it's likely due to not the modeling error, but really implementation of that code. Because when we're flying by Earth, we deal with the gravitational field in the following way. When you approach the Earth, you approach, in the code, you approach the so-called sphere of influence. And sphere of influence is imaginary boundary crossing which you can sort of forget about the external gravity and you deal with the gravity produced by the proper body, for example, Earth. And so when you're flying by Earth, you enter this the sphere of influence, you're getting by, and sort of when you're getting out, you're getting from that sphere of influence. It's rather sphere of influence of Earth is larger than the larger than the distance between Earth and the Moon. And so it's just the notional concept that it was used in the ODP to navigate the flyby. My gut feeling is that it's likely the code implementation of that concept might be erroneous. And confirmation for that, not confirmation, but hint is that when Rosetta flew by Earth in a couple of years ago and exhibited anomalous flyby, they needed to change the Earth's velocity in their model just a little bit to fit the data nicely. So essentially, if you play God and you sort of change the velocity of the planet you're flying by, you can fit the data. And it tells me that it's likely either model or code is erroneous. But it's again, it's a significant, very significant effort to chase this code error. We will look at this after Pioneer anomaly will be realized. But we will look at this. But sort of, this is my gut feeling, and people are trying to investigate using different approaches. Please. Every agency has different codes, but physics is the same, and physics is likely is obtained from the same book published by Ted Moyer in 2001. Basically, Ted Moyer used to be an engineer at JPL who actually documented the models that JPL uses to navigate. So maybe those models and concepts are being used as well by different groups. So now, let me switch gears. Very significant discovery and very significant effort was made thanks to Victor Toth, working with telemetry. Now, what telemetry is housekeeping information on the Pioneer spacecraft. You have 114 sensors installed on the spacecraft. Just one of them are listed here. It's the instrument compartment. They have. I don't expect you to read that, but basically, 114 sensors since launch until the last data point, until the last sort of day of spacecraft life, we were able to get very continuous coverage of what's happening on the spacecraft. Thermal sensors, power sensors, the pulse counts for maneuvers, many different pieces of information. Now, using this information, we realize that we can build a very extensive, a very elaborate finite element thermal model for the spacecraft. And we can actually use flight telemetry to calibrate this possible effect of anisotropic thermal radiation using the actual flight telemetry. So that's what we've done. This is what, thanks to Victor, you can have Pioneer 10, Pioneer 11 subsystems. You can select any possible route, any possible instrument, and you can get enough information. For example, Pioneer 10, all subsystems, you can get RTG, one root fin temperature. There are four RTGs. Each RTG had thermal sensors at the fin root, the thermal root. So essentially, you can have you can choose any possible data point you want. Almost 40 gigabytes of data, very significant effort. And thanks to Victor, we're able to get this extracted. Now, what you have, for example, just an indication. This is current of RTG3. You see, it decays. It's exhibit natural, what you expect. It's radio isotope decay. So this is RTG3 voltage, RTG4 current, RTG voltage. So basically multiplying by the two, you get the power. Now you can use the power figure to use as a boundary condition for your thermal model. So what we do, this is RTG root fin temperature. It's a linear decay also. So the point here is that the telemetry is consistent with our expectation that yes, indeed, because of the power, the decaying, you have a significant change. And if this is the effect, we should be able to see that anomaly, in the anomaly. So now let me move a little bit faster. We were able to build finite element thermal model, but building finite element thermal model for the spacecraft that is 30 plus years of age, very difficult because you don't have access to original drawings. People who were building the spacecraft in the 1960s, so some of them are no longer with us, and the information that is that they developed back then not really available. So we used the drawings, prior flight experience, project documents, photos, and we talked to the people, TRW, the company who built the spacecraft. We talked to TRW retirees to actually pick up their brains and try to understand what actually happened, when they built. It was a very interesting experience. A result is the following. So this is the spacecraft being tested at the Cape. This is a spacecraft at Smithsonian. If you ever go to Washington, D.C., go to Smithsonian and see the Pioneer 10. It sits up there very prominently in the Smithsonian Museum. This is the interior pictures of the instrument that are inside the instrument compartment. The point here is that they're all black. But why it is important? Because when you build thermal model, essentially what thermal model looks like, it solves numerically the radiation and the conduction equations. So essentially you have boundary conditions inside and it solves inside the spacecraft conduction and radiation. You compute the temperature of most exterior surface of the spacecraft using the flight telemetry as a boundary condition. And then you propagate radiation, so you solve equation numerically for radiation from the spacecraft. So this is very helpful. This is again the additional points. So now let me flip through. We split this, the surface on the spacecraft, roughly 3,000 surface elements. And for each element, we assign properties, geometry, materials, optical properties, emissivity, reflectivity. And now we can put the numerical code to live on those properties, on those structures. So first of all, this is the Pioneer geometric model. This is the Pioneer geometric model that we built. Compared to the actual sort of drawing of the spacecraft, that's how it looks like. I learned new English word, and it's interesting, thermally inconsequential. So what it means is that ideally you would like to see the cables and the sort of the booms here, but I was told by a thermal engineer, Slava, don't worry, it's thermally inconsequential. So basically the effect of this additional structure would be minimal for the purposes we study. So this is the spacecraft, how it looks like. Now this is the RTGs. And so having done that, we split the surface, as I said, for roughly 3,000 nodes and 2,600 plate elements, roughly 3.4 million radiation conductors, and 7,000 linear conductors. So it's a I'm not going to talk about this because it's not the appropriate audience, but I'm just giving you the flavor. It's a significant numerical problem to run this code. And it usually runs for at least a couple days before you get first one number. It's a significant number crunching exercise. Flight telemetry. We developed now results for different distances. But for example, this is flight telemetry at 25 astronomical units. This is the RTG root fin temperature. See the inboard and outboard RTGs. RTGs that are closer to the spacecraft would be a little bit warmer. And the RTGs that are outer from the spacecraft would be a little bit colder. So you see this is the outer RTG, this is the inner RTG. So if you see the difference, so it's pretty much this is the telemetry. We use this information to solve the numerical codes. This is what you see. This is the inboard, this is outboard. And basically you see flight telemetry tells us the temperature would be 133. It's not a good thing. For example, 142 Celsius. And so it's flight telemetry tells us this temperature, our model pretty much matches that. And so we can, originally we use the temperature as our boundary condition, but we then realized that if you use temperature, it might actually contribute to significant uncertainty because it's T to the fourth. So using power was Victor's suggestion. We have to rewrite most of the industry standard codes or write additional routines to actually utilize not thermal language, but power language, because power is available on the spacecraft. So we had to rewrite and use power to minimize the uncertainties. Please.
Just one question. How come stuff is so cold? How come stuff is so cold? It's out deep in space.
It is very cold.
But that seems quite hot.
Several kilos of plutonium inside generating 2.5 kilowatts of heat.
Okay.
So these are the RTGs. Now let's look at the spacecraft itself. So now we look at the, we use the telemetry data from inside the, inside the instrument compartment, thermal and power, and build again the additional information. And so this is the telemetry data that about different platform temperatures. Moving on. This is a wonderful table that we had to develop. Sorry to bother your attention with this, but that's reality. This is real life here. So when you assign properties of paints, surfaces, surface qualities on the spacecraft, you have to deal with all those wonderful elements that for theoretical physicists like me, totally foreign, but now I have to live through that. Sort of black paint, material, aluminum, thickness, density, emissivity, reflectivity, all of those properties must be part of your solution because this is how numerical code works. Additional table, you have many, many different elements. Now, that gets a little bit more interesting. Solution of the temperature inside the instrument compartment. See, these guys radiating a lot of thermal energy. So this is the temperature deposits on the bottom part and the top part of the inside the instrument compartment. And then it goes to the sort of temperature percolates to the through the thickness of the compartment, the thickness wall. This is the temperature on the outside of the wall. And then sort of the temperature predicted and flight telemetry. So there's some discrepancies, but those discrepancies are not really significant because then what you have multi-layer insulation. So it's this spacecraft is wrapped into multi-layer insulation. And you see the temperature gradients get smoother. Very smooth, and again, I'd like to highlight that the colors are misleading because the temperatures here minus 19 and minus 61, and this is where the temperature is really misleading. So this is the high gain antenna, and you see temperatures exaggerate the sort of visual impact of the temperature, but here temperature minus 97 Celsius, minus 99. It's a really tiny deposit of temperature, but again, it tells us the true story because this is one RTG, this is another RTG, and this is magnetometer boom. So we see this even the pattern on the backside of the, on the sort of high gain antenna tells you the right story. So moving on, what we decided to do, we enclose the spacecraft in the control volume. It's a sort of hypothetical volume that is roughly 40 distances, 40 diameters away from the spacecraft. And so imagine you cover this sphere with the photo, sort of with photo detectors. So they see the bolometers, so they count photons coming from the spacecraft. And so you collect the total amount of the infrared energy, and then you look for any possible anisotropy. And indeed, we the total energy that we count on the control volume is very consistent with the total energy emitted by the spacecraft. And I'm not going to do that. But here, how you see the anisotropy? Anisotropy is there. So the thing is, the closer you are in the solar system, you expect that the sun will contribute significantly. Spacecraft is being impacted by the solar energy. We'll have to redistribute. And so how to read that? This is the polar angle. This is the spacecraft axis. If this is looking away from the sun, sort of away from the sun, this is sort of, this will push toward the sun, this will push from away from the sun. And so you expect that the total energy along different polar slices, this is would be uniform if the, spacecraft, how should I put this? So what we do, basically we slice the total area by 5 degrees and we collected all the temperature deposits along the 5 degrees slices. And the plot that you will see will sort of show the total energy deposits here and along each slice. So what it is showing here is that at 3U distance, when the sun is very dominant, you see the spacecraft reacts to the solar presence. when the spacecraft recedes away from the solar system and sun is not very significant, you see that the true anomaly picks up. So the blue curve, the green curve here is the distance AC astronomical unit. And you see that really, indeed, the spacecraft emits energy, proper energy, when there is no sun. It emits anisotropically. And this is the Pioneer anomaly. Maybe not all of it. We don't know at the moment. I mean, I think we have a good understanding, but maybe in 6 months' time, we should be able to tell you what is the numerical size. But indeed, we see the fact that the thermal anisotropy, anisotropic thermal radiation on the spacecraft may contribute to the Pioneer anomaly. The question is to what level. And so basically, if we count this anomaly in terms of the acceleration, you can see in terms of what? You see that it's minus 442. Remember that plot I showed you when onset of the anomaly. That is likely the explanation of this, because at a certain distance of roughly 15 astronomical units, it gets to the point it's 40 watt, 47, 49, and it stays pretty much constant. Remember that you need to roughly 67 watt electrical energy to explain the anomaly. I think we're almost there. There is still discrepancy, and the numbers may vary, but largest part of the anomaly is likely explained, but it's not the final result. The question is how to really quantify the numbers that we have here. For people who saw the glimpse of the needle in the haystack, how to tell them that really it was just a glimpse. And so the question is how to develop proper uncertainty, how to quantify this result in terms of the proper numbers, not just a number, but uncertainty. Because you see, the paints on the spacecraft, when you launch this the spacecraft in space, paint is being bombarded by the high energy particles, protons. And so the emissivity and reflectivity of the paint changes. So for the 30 years the spacecraft was in space, emissivity might change. And emissivity may significantly affect the anisotropy of thermal radiation. Things like that may significantly increase the uncertainty. We don't know the uncertainty yet. So I'd like you to keep this in mind and just sort of keep it here, don't take it anywhere. But reality is that there is we need to quantify the uncertainty. However, the indication is that a significant part of the anomaly likely will be attributed to those mechanisms. There's still remaining part of the anomaly. And for some people, for example, if we can if thermal mechanism explains roughly what, let's say 5 × 10⁻¹⁰ meters per second squared, remaining 2 or 3, for some people will get even more interesting, because there are some models like, you know, MOND predict you 2 × 10⁻¹⁰, right? Or some other mechanisms, really, the C times H, if you take it properly, it's roughly what, it's about 4 × 10⁻¹⁰. So the danger here is really not leaving the remaining part of the anomaly uncertain, or sort of to properly assign this remaining 25%. What is it? This is the main challenge. So this is why pretty much the work is still ongoing and we're still not publishing the results. But for you, this is what we have. And so as I'd like to finish my presentation, here is the most fun part of the investigation has just begun, because the data, finally, Doppler data became available last October. After all this recovery, after all calibration, extraction, removing all the blunder points, removing all those corruption in the data, the data became available as of October 2009. So the fun part of the investigation has just begun. So stay tuned, and we should be able to conclude this part of the investigation in the next 6 months or so. So, but this is it. So thank you very much for your attention and for your patience.
Questions?
Yes.
So a while back I saw a talk where it was claimed that rotation curves, the rotation curves in the galaxies are flat out. So it was claimed that the problem with that was not that they were actually, that there was a problem in the Doppler, but in fact they weren't flat out. They were using a perturbative GR, and in fact, when you use curve type metric, all these problems are solved, and it's not that the speed of the planets or the stars is constant. It's just that they have a problem calculating the Doppler effect, because they're using perturbative GR, when in fact it's non-perturbative effects of GR, by using a curve, which you get by using a curve metric. And probably that solves the problem, I don't know. Could this be potentially a cause of the remaining 25% of the anomaly? If the from the rotation of the solar system?
Let's talk about this in 6 months.
Okay.
I mean, there are so many speculations, so many different ideas, and as time progresses, we see that some of those ideas just don't hold water. And here, let's just wait a little bit. I mean, it's still the thermal mechanism became a very significant contribution here, and so we need to understand the proper sizing of that. But intuitively, I think the answer is no, but let's talk later.
I mean, the difference between predicted and observed prediction curves is quarter kilometers. The lens current precession due to the mass of the galaxy. I mean, it's very
it was the change in the Doppler effect. Was there something that somehow the I don't know. I mean, I didn't see the paper. I was asking for.
Is there a Cooperstock paper that you researched?
Cooperstock.
Fred Cooperstock published a thing that he didn't publish it, and he just published it. Because this paper on the field, I've got five papers here immediately saying it's wrong. However, the claim is that you take into account the fact that the stars are rotating in the galaxy, and you have a real exact solution. Involving angular momentum. Then this would explain the fact that N, if flat rotation curves, is given in its own effect. And I believe in those papers that criticize this thing as well. But that's my opinion.
I didn't see the papers, I just saw it.
Yeah.
And besides, if this would be the source of this anomaly, we should be able to see the same effects in inner planet in the solar system that would be perturbed by, you know, 1,000%. Pretty much the level of precision we have for Mars is less than a meter, 70 centimeters. So effects like that, and even at the level you said, would be tens of meters. So we don't see this.
So you can also use post-Newtonian arguments as the motion of stars in the galaxy. Because the gravitational force in the stars is small, the gravitational fields are weak. And Garfinkel published a paper showing that PPA calculations simply is not feasible, or just not feasible. Simply doesn't.
Well, I mean, for that particular thing, for the planets, the point that would be the Doppler thing, just seeing as the faraway planets, we don't see it. Like that would go for the inner planets where we see them.
Right.
Radar, but the other planets apparently it's flyby, so that mechanism would be.
Cassini is at Saturn, and Cassini gets two way Dopplers, so you get two way Doppler to the distance.
The two main data types are Doppler observations and radar observations, sort of range observations. The easiest one, every spacecraft is equipped with Doppler. And for range, you need to have clock on board. Or one-way range, which is just not visible yet. I mean, we don't have it. So most spacecraft would rely on Doppler, if not every. So Doppler is prominent everywhere. Cassini goes there, or any other spacecraft, they still send Doppler signals.
Cassini also has range.
Of course, of course. But then sort of the point was that the Doppler model for the Doppler observations really was questioned. And so for Doppler, for spacecraft, Doppler is the primary observation and the range is additional.
Any other questions? Well, thank you, Mark.